BFM, CBS Radio, 866-570-PEN is the phone number, 7366. PennRadio@gmail.com, PennRadio.com. Michael Goudeau is at my home in Las Vegas, in my studio there, and I am here in New York City. And we have had, of the aristocrats that we've had on the show, we have had Louis Black, Lisa Lampanelli, Howie Mandel, Meryl Marco, David Brenner, Wendy Liebman, Gilbert Gottfried, Paul Prevenza, Bobby Slayton, Carrot Top, Trey Parker, Drew Carey, Bob Saget, Phyllis Diller, The Passing Zone, Doug Stanhope, Fred Willard, and now in the studio. Coming in the studio with what? You had 15 seconds to spare?
32
seconds to spare. We have Kevin Pollak.
What a pleasure to see you, sir.
And we didn't even shake hands before you came
in.
So we're really... We'll wait till there's a break and then go. And we've got an hour show, Kevin, to talk about anything you want.
Fantastic.
Just take it over. You know, this isn't just, you know, do a little shot on Letterman. This is, you can just have the show. I'm totally burned out. I've been flying all over.
Right.
I've got nothing to say.
Okay.
So you've got, take over the show, do whatever you want.
Wow, no pressure here.
No, none at all. You've got no
sense. None whatsoever. Well, where do I dive in? As it were. Let's see. Holidays?
Sure. Holidays?
Right smack in front of us.
Right into the holidays.
Yeah. Don't care for them.
Don't like them?
No. It's not a bah humbug thing. It's I don't like people, especially family.
Right.
Yeah.
And hey, where are you from? Where are your family from?
Originally San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
And, it's too much pressure. And I had a nice Thanksgiving. That was fine.
How many people?
Because there's more food involved of very specific nature. Just me, my ma, and my stepdad. Yeah, just the three of us. That was fine, you know, because there's Guinness involved. But the Christmas thing, the pressure of New Year's, are you kidding me?
Now, you're a Jew, right?
Pretty much.
Yeah, a Jew. So what makes you think you're supposed to like Christmas?
Well,
after killing Christ.
First of all, he was, of course, a Jew.
Yes.
And by the way, I didn't understand the whole controversy over the Passion of the Christ, why the Orthodox Jews were all pissed off. You know, the question of Romans are the Jews, Romans are the Jews, Romans are the Jews. Oh, it was the Jews.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know how I know this?
How do you know that?
Because everyone was Jewish.
Everyone?
Yeah. It's not like the Lord had a son born in Ethiopia. You know, he was born in Jewtown. Right? So then he's walking around talking about...
The term is Hybetown.
All right, it's fine. I like to clean it up, but
okay.
Sure. And then he's walking around talking about peace and love.
Mm-hmm.
You got to go. How long do you think that would last today in Texas?
Not long.
Yeah. No. Son, we ain't got time for 40 lashes. We're just going to put you on a rope. No, leave that cross. I got a schedule. Come on now. There's way too much. Well, so anyways, I was raised in a very reform Jewish family.
How reform?
So reform, we're Catholic.
Yeah.
So there was a Christmas tree until I was old enough, 5 or 6, to have the menorah and the lighting of the candles explained to me.
Mm-hmm.
But by then, I wouldn't have no Christmas tree. So we were so reform, we had a Hanukkah bush.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And, man, what a bad idea that was.
Hanukkah bush. See, we didn't have... I'm from a small town in Massachusetts, and we had 2 Jewish families in the entire town.
Wow.
So what I knew about Jewish culture was entirely what I got from Lenny Bruce.
Oh, wow.
To me, every Jew was Lenny Bruce. That was it. So I had no idea at all. So you can tell me about the Hanukkah bush.
Yeah. Well, the Hanukkah bush is a Christmas tree. First of all, let's not kid ourselves. And it's got lights on it, and it's surrounded by presents. Remarkably like the Tannenbaum.
And a star at the top?
Sure.
Sure, why not?
Except it's got 6 points.
I see.
Yeah. No pentagram for us.
No.
Didn't make sense. So the whole holiday just represents pressure and disappointment.
Do you buy presents?
You know, I do. And the whole present thing is, you know, from the family, oh my, you know, you just can't believe it's another blank gift. I really can't believe it's another blank gift.
What do they give you?
Crap. Just an amazing assortment of crap. Here's another thing I'll never use. Look at that. Wow.
Any good examples of that?
Well...
Or you don't want to, you know, all your family are avid listeners to the Penn Jillette Show.
Yeah, that's why I'm cutting loose. Because it's never come up before. What's it? Oh, yeah. A Kleenex box in the form of a face. So you're taking the tissue right out of the face's mouth.
Oh, it's a,
out of the face's nose, sorry.
It's a Kleenex
top,
a cover.
Dispenser,
the Kleenex
if you will.
Dispenser.
So, you know, that just...
Where's that now?
Exactly.
Wait, do you have it somewhere in your home?
I sold it on eBay for a dollar.
Have you sold anything on eBay?
I haven't, but I figured out a system to take all the swag that I get and
why you don't say swag? You say swag.
Well, it's whatever. Sure. Yeah,
in the Kearney, it's called slum. You know.
Is that right?
Yeah, they call it slum.
Oh, cool.
So I had to learn to say swag.
Right.
Yeah. I would say, you know, what slum have you got in terms of T-shirts?
I like slum better.
Yeah, isn't it better?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know the guess your weight thing, which when you're a kid, you're really proud to figure out the guess your weight. How do they make money on the guess your weight? Well, you know, the prize is worth less than you paid.
Yeah.
And that piece of information is really the secret to all life.
That's
you
know? Right.
The prize is worth less than you paid.
Yeah.
And you think you're competing. Aha! It was 5 pounds off.
Yeah.
I'm 174. And you cheer, and then you've got a little troll doll with purple hair.
And you can't believe
you paid $5 for them to guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's all that stuff on that the shelves is called slum.
Oh, wow. Ernie. So all the free crap that I'll get at various functions,
mm-hmm.
I've now given to a friend who set up an eBay account to sell it on.
Just to sell?
And she's done very well.
Kevin Pollock's crap.
Exactly. Now, naturally, she doesn't list it as such. Because she's a smart gal.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Do you know there are people that earn their living with just proper spelling on eBay?
No.
It's the coolest thing in the world. A lot of people put stuff up on eBay who can't spell. So what people do is they will search for misspellings of cool stuff, like guitar with a Q.
Okay.
You know? And they'll search through there, and they find things that are really valuable that are misspelled.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody can find them. And then they bid on them, which is very low because they're not competing against anyone, take the same pictures, take the same everything, and put them back up with the proper spelling.
Genius.
So you can now make a living as a good speller.
That's genius.
Yeah.
Wow.
That could be your whole living.
You're not saying that the country's made up of C-minus students, are you?
I'm not saying that, no. I think the country has to be made. It's a straight curve. It's a bell curve.
Let me say, the country is made up of C-minus students.
C-minus students?
Yes.
What kind of student were you?
C-minus.
Okay, so there we go. Me no. too.
I was a B-minus, actually.
Yeah, okay.
But I was the class clown. So I think I got some of those better grades because I made the teacher laugh as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, couldn't wait to do that.
Now you were just on Letterman the Impressionist Week.
Impressionist Week, yeah, that was a little strange for me
because they decided they had mostly like just goofball impressionists, right? And then they decided to throw you in.
You're not calling Gordy Brown a goofball, are you? You got to go back to Vegas.
No,
you know?
I know. He's a very nice guy. But what I'm trying to say to you is,
yes,
you never build yourself as an impressionist, did you?
You know, I didn't. Although I should have certainly early on, and starting out in stand-up at a very young age, 18, all I did was impressions at first.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually, that was the first time I ever did stand up on a talk show. And I'm talking maybe 70 talk show appearances later.
You mean you always did the
appearance? I always, it was the only time that I grabbed the reins of my destiny and succeeded. At a very early age. You remember Jim McCauley, the gatekeeper of the Tonight Show when Carson did the Tonight Show?
Sure.
He was the ultimate gatekeeper. This guy you could not get past. He would circle your act for months or years before he allowed you on. And he also knew that you had to have two or three shots ready, because if Johnny loved you, you were back on in 6 weeks.
Right.
And if he ever booked the wrong guy, he knew Johnny would rip off his head and down his neck. So he finally circled. Now, again, I'd been dreaming of doing the Tonight Show since I was 10. So when he finally circled and approached me, I was maybe 28, I think. And I'd just been to L.A. a couple of years. And he said, "You're ready to do the Tonight Show. I want, you know, I've seen your act now here at the Improv or whatever, and you're ready to do the show." And I said, "You know, I've been waiting since I was 10 to hear this said to me, and I think I'll have a much greater impact from the couch, to be honest with you. When I do my Peter Falk one eye moving for Johnny sitting next to him, it will actually have an impact on my career, I believe, versus the okay sign from Johnny after doing my 6 minutes standing on the star in the middle of the stage.
Uh-huh.
Now, I know you can't bring me out to the couch because there's a protocol. I have to have a TV show or a movie. But I'm willing to wait until I do, because I think I just really, really believe that I will have an impact on the couch that I won't have standing on the star.
That's really gutsy.
And he looked, well, I was in my 20s.
Okay.
So he looked at me. Yeah, don't make that mistake now. What can I get? So he looked at me like I was from another planet for several long beats and said, I can't disagree with you, but people don't say no to me, you know, and I knew the history of this guy. And I started explaining, well, you know, the guys who blow my mind now are like Albert Brooks and David Steinberg and Steve Martin, the guys who are doing their act but from the couch, you know. So that's what I'm talking about doing is my act but from the couch in conversational form. And he said, no, I get it. I get it. I just, wow. So, and I said, by the way, I may call you back in an hour and beg for this opportunity you're now offering me. And also the big part of this is I had no prospects for a TV show or a movie when I said this to him. I wasn't even getting auditions. I was auditioning for commercials at that point, like all the other comedians in town. And it took about a year and a half, and I did this movie, Willow, and it was enough of a... had me back on 2-3 times a year till he retired. And it was, like I said, the only time I really sort of took the reins and had it paid off so incredibly well. So that's all I ever did all these years until I got the call from Letterman a couple of weeks ago saying, we're doing Impressionist Week. And I thought, because I'd seen Ventriloquist Week.
Yeah.
Which I actually enjoyed.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's because you weren't on it.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Yeah, I actually enjoyed that. And so the impression, they said, well, we'll build you, you know, you'll be on the last night. And, of course, we'll mention it all nights. And Rich Little is starting off. And, of course, when I was really young, Rich Little was the impressionist guru, you know. So there was something symmetric about that. And you know, I heard that it was Dave's idea to do this, which I kind of liked. And also, to be honest with you, the best part of it was to be scared again.
Well, I like you. What I like about it is you being marginalized into the ghetto of entertainers. Because you know, when the first time I almost met you, I went directly to the hospital. You were working with us. Working with us in a show, and I was so sick that they had EKG things on me while I was performing, and they were backstage while you were on. I could hear you in the background. I had a fever of 104, and the head of Caesars was back there going, "We can't have you go on if it's bad for you." But there are a lot of people out there that paid to see you. And the EMTs are going, don't go on. And meanwhile, you're doing your act in the background. So when I have fever dreams, it's your voice I hear. And you, to me, were like a comic. And then, you know, you were in Usual Suspects. And you were this monster actor. And you were always the regular, you know, just you were really doing it. And I, no matter how much success Teller and I had, we were still magicians. You're really funny for magicians. You know, you're really interesting for magicians. You know, we were just in this, you know, it's a Special Olympics of show business. So when I heard that you were on Impressionist Week with Letterman, I was like, yes, he's a brother. We're the, you know, you might as well have been on Ventriloquist Week,
right,
or, you know,
right,
or
right, right,
or
right.
Mime Week.
Right. That's what's got to be next, by the way.
Yeah, exactly.
Mime Week.
Yeah, Mime Week. He's got to go to that. So I was very happy that doing your Christopher Walken. Don't do it. And a friend, very good, very good. I mean, put in your little dancing monkey suit, and you know, because you were out of it, and then you came back.
Yeah.
No one has ever done that. You know, Steve Martin kind of with a wink tried to say, okay, I'm a big star, and now I'll do a little magic.
Fly-dee-dee.
But it was a big wink to that, you know, and Johnny Carson saying, oh, I used to do magic. I mean, no one mentioned that he absolutely sucked as a magician.
Right.
He talked to you about magic, he knew nothing, you know, but he tried to claim to be a magician. But no one has taken that step. And I would, I didn't get to see it. But friends of mine said Kevin Pollak was on Impression this week. And I was like, yes! I mean, it really is great. It's fabulous.
I went from pitching to catching. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that shows a great deal of versatility.
Thank you.
Total destruction of ego.
Yes. I did. I had to let go of the part of me that was saying, you've been sitting for 70 appearances. Why would you stand?
Why would you
stand? You're too lazy to stand.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, honestly, to be scared again, I found fascinating. Because nothing in show business had scared me as I was trying to cram 4.5 minutes into this, you know, appearance. Mm-hmm. How am I going to do 4.5 minutes? Because we, you know, we do an hour or an hour and a half more, you know,
sure.
and 4.5 minutes, what? And to maintain the storytelling style that I've sort of become to love, in 4.5, you know, it's like, so just to be scared, quite honestly, was the thrilling part.
It's a great feeling.
That shocked me. I did not realize how scared I was going to be.
Well, I can't wait till he has Mime Week and the all week it leads up to, and Kevin Pollak. And you're out there in, like, white face that doesn't quite fit over your 5 o'clock shadow, and, you know, black tights with the hair of your leg sticking through, you know, and putting up a little sign.
Now this sounds great.
Sounds really
I would love to be a part of that.
I think so. Maybe we can do a mime team thing.
Oh, man.
And
change our name.
So did you come over afterwards on the couch and talk after that?
Oh, no. It was strictly stand-up. Yeah.
You just did 4.5 minutes and stuff?
Well, it ended up being 6. They said we want 4.5 minutes of material because with laughter and applause breaks, it's going to be a 6-minute thing. And it was 6 minutes and 50 seconds.
Because there was a lot more applause than they thought there'd be.
Baby.
Sure there was.
Yeah.
And
I did take a shot at Dave, which was kind of fun.
Did you do it? Did you do an impersonation?
Out. No. I just said it's great to be here on Impressionist Week. It's always great to be in a late show, you know, see Paul, the great band, and Danny. But this is what? Dave, right. Right. He just looks like a Danny to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I know that everybody that's listening to this has seen it except me, so it's a really odd conversation, but I'm still so excited. Did you do one of those things like, you know, my car broke down in Hollywood, and who should come up to help me but Christopher Walken? And I said, Christopher, do you have a jack? And he said, no, but maybe my friend William Shatner does. And then who would, but the motorcycle cop drove up, and he was Albert Brooks.
Yeah. You know,
you didn't do any story like that?
That's hilarious. I
was in an airplane.
Yeah.
And the stewardess was, you didn't do any of that, huh?
When I first started out 20, many years ago, I remember doing, because I was a waiter at this restaurant in the Bay Area and then got to do stand-up also at some point.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually I sort of became the feature at the restaurant performer and stopped having to be a waiter. But for a while, so I used to do a thing in the act where, I love being a waiter and doing the impressions. You know, most waiters, when the cook screws up, you don't want that pressure when you go to the table and they say, we asked for rice and we got a baked potato. But I would find my tips would go up when the cook screwed up because I could, you know, go into Peter Falk. They said rice. I'm sorry. I said potato. I was crystal clear with the man. And, you know, I would do my...
You really can't do the eye.
Oh, yeah. And by the way,
I've never seen you do that,
which is great for radio. But when I
but I will tell people because it's the wonder of radio that we can live in this fantasy world. His eye actually crawled out of the socket, went down his cheek, and over across. Now, did you practice that?
When but when I met after I did,
I feel so much. You are doing so much because you know I spent working on the Pharaoh Shuffle.
Right.
I spent probably 700 hours. So the fact that you were trying to learn to move your eyes independently to do Peter Falk, I feel so great that you're a cat. I feel wonderful that you're at the bottom. We're going to take a break. We'll be back. We got Kevin Pollak. This is Ben Gillette on the radio, CBS Radio, Free FM. Yeah, this is Ben Gillette on the Free FM, 866-570-PEN-7366. But don't bother calling. I'm not going to take any calls. I'm talking to Kevin the whole time, but I'm so used to giving the phone number, it's just automatic. PennRadio@gmail.com, PennRadio.com. I am in New York City with Kevin Pollak, and the band you heard playing in is the Mike Jones Big Band, and Mike Jones is playing at the Knickerbocker Friday and Saturday night, and I'm going to sit in and play some bass with him. But for the rest of the time, the upright will be played by Jay Leonard, who's actually a fabulous bass player as opposed to a mediocre hack, which is what I am. But I'll sit in and play the Knickerbocker Friday and Saturday. I'll play like, you know, 45 minutes, and then the rest of the time, about 3 hours, will be Jay Leonard playing with Mike Jones. So two of the fabulous bebop players, a great, great duo, will be at the Knickerbocker, and I'll be there too. And I'm talking to Kevin Pollak and told you how we were stupider about Johnny Carson.
Yeah.
So we never went on the Carson show with Carson because we hung tough. We went on the Carson show with Jay Leno. and then Carson ended up, after he retired, calling me a lot and talking about The Aristocrats, which he loved as an idea for a movie. And he also was a big fan of our Showtime show, which, as I say here, is Bull's hit. He was a big fan of that show and loved it and would call me after everyone showed and talk about it. And the sad thing, you want to have your heart broken here?
Please.
Johnny said that when The Aristocrats was done, would we please go to Sundance, show it, and then would we be his guest in Malibu and show him the DVD of The Aristocrats. And the day after it showed at Sundance, the next day, while Provenza and I were celebrating at Starbucks with a hot chocolate, I get the phone call that he died.
Oh, man.
So I never met him. I talked to him on the phone and exchanged emails, but never met him. And he was so, I mean, he would just talk to me. It was cool emails because one of the things I'm most proud of is I never asked him to do The Aristocrats.
Right.
Because it was one of his favorite jokes. He loved the idea of the movie, but said in the very first email to me, I am retired, would love to do this, but cannot. And I never wrote back and said, like, please,
right,
or wouldn't that be great? I just said, can we show it to you when we're done?
Yeah.
You know, so, but he...
What a thrill, though.
It was an amazing thrill. And it was a thrill that after I would, you know, tape somebody for The Aristocrats, we were editing it and stuff, I would, you know, drop an email to Johnny and he would call and talk about what a great idea it was and how cool it was and say, who's getting the dirtiest? You know, always wanted to know that. So.
He would have loved the Albert Brooks one because he loved Albert Brooks.
Oh, yeah. Well, Albert Brooks.
the thing I did in the special features.
Yes.
I'm glad made the cut on the special features because I watch it and I'm it's hard to be objective about anything we do, but that makes me laugh. Because it's the channeling of Albert and I feel like it's Albert.
Well, you know, when we did the first
the
cut of The Aristocrats, it was 2 hours and 20 minutes. Every single thing you did was in that.
Oh, my God.
And we did a few edits.
Yeah.
And I remember once yelling at Provenza, you've cut out Kevin doing the Christopher Walken. We've got to have that in there.
Right.
And then I got the next cut, and I said, you've cut out Kevin doing the Albert Brooks.
Right.
That's got to be in there.
Yeah.
And then we did a hybrid with you doing both of them and finally had to bite the bullet and say.
I think you made the right call, honestly. You leave one intact and
yeah,
then have the other one of the special features.
But it was, and you talked about that in more detail than we showed in the movie, about you channeling Albert Brooks to talk about how you're funnier.
Actually funnier.
Doing Albert Brooks.
Funnier and faster than doing him. It doesn't make sense. Can I just say that? Is it me? Am I crazy? This is weird. I walk in this building. There's a man downstairs with a clipboard. He said, are you famous? I said, who are you? He said, sign here. See, I can't think that fast. No way.
And you called Albert Brooks and everything, right?
Oh, no. It started with me doing a... I was on my outgoing message on my machine.
Okay.
That's how I used to test new voices. I'd put them on the machine. Hi, this is Albert Brooks. How are you? I can't believe I'm doing this. Kevin's not here. I'm going to go lie down. I'm nauseous. Leave a message. Call back. I don't care. And I started getting these phone calls and hang-ups, which was a sign that it was circulating and
mm-hmm,
people had nothing to say. They were just listening, which is never, you know, a good thing for anyone insecure because there's no response.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they're hanging up because it sucks. And then I finally someone leaves them. Hi, this is Rob Reiner. You don't know me, but I grew up with Albert. We've been best friends since we were in high school, and that's amazing. And he hangs up the phone. This is, of course, years and years before I did A Few Good Men. Not only worked with Rob, but I'd never met him. You know, this. So I'm dancing around my apartment. Rob Reiner called. Oh, my God. And then after about 9 minutes of that, I thought, you idiot. You could have picked up the phone and talked to Rob Reiner. I was frozen when I heard his voice on the machine. So, 19 hang-ups later, I hear, hi, this is Carl Reiner. I don't know if you heard, but there's a lot of people very excited about this impression. Now I'm ready to talk to a Reiner. So I dive at the phone and pick it up, and he says, you know, we've never met, but... I said, well, your son called. He said, yeah, yeah, well, I told Rob to call. And you know, Albert grew up in my house hanging out with Robbie. So, you know, I saw this brilliant guy since he was a kid, and that's an amazing impression, blah, blah, blah. And he said, you know, Rob called Albert and had Albert call. And apparently didn't leave a message, but called Rob right back and said, is that me, really? Sounds like my Uncle Zeke. Uncle Zeke. Come on. Zeke Brooks. Or Zeke Einstein.
Zeke Einstein, yeah.
Is even
Ezekiel Einstein.
Less likely. So that happened, and then I somehow wormed my way into Larry King's radio show on Mutual Radio many years ago, right? And because he loved Albert Brooks also and had him on. And that's where I became sort of a regular guest on Larry's radio show. And once, while sitting in his studio, Albert called in. I had been doing the impression on the air, and Albert called in. And Larry, of course, Albert, what do you think? This guy's pretty good. Larry, I don't know what to tell you. I was driving in my car, listening, and, you know, it was amazing. It was weird. And then I got pulled over, and the cop gave me 2 tickets. He was listening to Kevin and listening to me try to get out of the ticket. He gave me 2 tickets. And so Larry said, but it's good. I said, well, listen, it's flattering. I called my attorney as an 800 number, and he said it was illegal, so I guess it's okay. and then the word kind of got around the L.A. Improv, where, you know, 20 years ago it was a place where, you know, really had a great impact and meant something, and where Bud Friedman and his partner would look through you like a hologram until you got something going in your career, and then it was best friends. And there was the round table at the Improv, where it was, you know, the kings of the comedy would sit. So once I get a call, after everyone knew that I was obsessed with Albert Brooks, and from Jimmy Miller, who, of course, went on to manage such big stars as Jim Carrey and Will Ferrell and so on, and brother Dennis Miller. And Jimmy called and said, Albert Brooks is here. Get down to the Improv. He's at the table. So I raced down there. And now, you know, I'm finally going to meet him face to face. And I get to the round table, and all the seats are taken. And I'm looking around, everyone's sitting there, and I'm thinking, who really doesn't care that they're here? As in, who's going to get up? How long is it going to be? Because Albert Brooks is holding court, and who's going to move? And Franklin Ajay, who I've always loved, was one of the guys sitting at the table. And I said... I said, he'll be up soon. And so while I'm circling, waiting for Franklin to get up, which of course he eventually did,
sure.
You know, you didn't need to speak with the amazing Kreskin to figure that one out, who, by the way, was never amazing. So I'm circling, and Albert sees me, and he would look up and say, hi, Kevin, how you doing? Sit down. Listen, so I, and then he would turn to somebody else and start talking to him. Clearly, he knew there was no seat.
Uh-huh.
Each of the 9 times, he would interrupt one of his stories to look up at me and say, Kevin, seriously, sit down, you're making me nervous. So anyways, Larry, what happened was, and I'm circling, and there's no seats, and he keeps telling me to sit down. So, you know, he's having fun, and that's making me happy enough. And then eventually, Franklin gets up. And I remember one of the stories, he just told stories, and... But then he said, you know, I saw you first do me on the Mac and Jamie Comedy Hour, and, you know, 11 people saw that show.
Uh-huh.
And he saw, I don't know if he got a tape of it or something, and it was really good, and I couldn't believe it. You were doing me. Why is this anyone doing me? So then one story he told that always made me laugh, he says, you know, my father was a famous radio comic, Park Your Carcass, and he's buried now in one of those celebrity cemeteries, you know, where Marilyn Monroe and all these people are buried. And right next to his grave is... Shemp Howard from the Three Stooges. And I have this recurring nightmare
where I'm at my father's grave and I'm leaning over and I'm paying my respects and I look over next to me and there's Mo stabbing the dirt with his two fingers of Shep's grave saying, "You bastard, I can't get work as a singer."
And that had me on the floor. Yeah, so it's just really being in his presence was phenomenal.
And he's my hero. You did the impersonation for him.
Yeah. He and I've since talked to him and run into him on occasion, and he could not be more endearing and lovely.
I talked to him about the Aristocrats. Mm. I got him on the phone and explained that we were doing this whole thing, and he was, it was one of the most astonishing conversations of my life. He just said, "Pan, it's a great idea. I understand it. I understand it completely. It's a fabulous idea. I'm not going to do it. And I'll tell you why. The reason is I'm a nut. And I'm not going to do it no matter what you tell me. You can explain it to me more. I assure you, I understand the idea well enough to do it myself, but I'm not going to do it. And I have no reason at all." How much do you make in Vegas? You're making more than me. Is there still a sign that says no one knows who Danny Gads is beyond this point? Is that still there? You're making more than me because my last movie sucks. Is that right? Should I be doing a live act in Vegas? What do you make a week? I'm not going to do it. What kind of camera are you using? And I was on the phone with him for 45 minutes, and I said, "Well, you know, Albert, you know how much you'd mean. I know exactly how much I mean to this movie, what a great idea it is, and it's probably going to be good for my career, except I'm not going to do it. Wonderful talking to you, Ben."
Wow.
It was just, it was just so funny.
Yeah.
So insanely funny. And he did. He understood it completely and never gave me a reason for why he wasn't doing it. It was fabulous. And that's still a conversation that I remember forever.
Yeah.
You know, except that I just realized that I was doing an Albert Brooks impersonation while you were sitting across from me, and now I'm humiliated. We're going to take a break right after this.
Is there a CD I can get of this?
Yeah, you can. You can go to penradio.com. You can get it free.
Beautiful. Yeah,
that's a good bass player, isn't it?
Yes.
I'm playing the upright bass on it.
Is that right?
I have the calluses to prove it. So you got some show on the Sci-Fi Channel?
Miniseries, which is why I'm here in New York.
Sorry, I didn't mean to say show.
Yeah, what's the matter with
you? It's a miniseries.
Speaking of pimping, this free FM thing, were they that concerned about the satellite radio that they had to create free FM as a moniker?
I don't know. I guess other names were taken.
Because they're pimping the hell out of it. Free FM.
Free FM, yeah.
I mean, you would hear Letterman or even Carson, I think, at some point during the act when things weren't going well in the talk show, would look at the audience and say, "This is free." You know, and it always made me laugh. And then when I started hearing these promos for free FM, I thought, really?
Yeah.
Do you need to tell people they're not paying for something?
Well, you know, there are like 8 million people who do satellite radio.
Uh-huh.
And you know how many radios there are? You know how many radios there are?
Of the satellites?
No.
Oh.
Radios. The radio that you have that's free?
Yes.
You know how many there are of those? It's a very funny number. 1 billion. There are 1 billion radios in the world.
In the world.
Yeah, 1 billion.
Wow.
1 billion people.
I would have not have guessed anywhere near that.
So if you do a graph of how, you know, what 5 million looks like next to
a billion.
Yeah. It's just insane. So I don't think they should worry about it. But,
that was really, of course, sort of my point.
They were bitch slapped pretty hard
by
that gentleman that went to the satellite.
A little bit.
They were confused, and they felt used and broken and tossed away.
Sure.
So they moved on.
Yeah.
But, so this is free, and Sci-Fi Channel.
As is the Sci-Fi Network. Also free.
Once you get basic cable.
All right, then.
You can't just put rabbit ears on top of the set.
$6. $6 a month, and you can have the Sci-Fi Network.
And what's your Miniseries?
Miniseries is called The Lost Room. And it debuts December 11th, 12th, and 13th, or airs originally. Those 3 nights, 2 hours each night, 6 hours total.
It's a lot of Pollock.
Yeah. Well, it's a lot of Peter Krause and Juliana Margulies, and then enough Pollock.
And what do you play?
I would say. I play the Jew. No. Actually, his name is Creutzfeldt, so I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But he's a wealthy. The story is very intricate and smart and weird and Twilight Zone-y and kind of the Fugitive meets the Twilight Zone in design. And there are objects to be collected and rooms that the key opens only, and it's just very trippy. And so I play one of these guys who's trying to collect these objects that give him special powers, only we don't really know that at first.
And is this in the future?
No, no. That's the fun part.
It's now.
It's present day.
Wow.
And this society came to be in the 40s. And when these one or two of these objects were first found,
so it's like the Illuminati or something,
if you will.
Okay,
and
or the Jews.
Yeah, I actually do have to leave soon because I have to take Mel Brooks to shul. So keep that in mind.
But there's a secret society. And you're the bad guy?
You know, the drinking cutoff in California, Los Angeles specifically, is .08.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's where you shouldn't be driving.
Right.
Now, you know .08 is nothing,
yeah,
really.
Yeah.
It's not drunk. It's mm-hmm. tipsy. And I like that it's low, because we don't want people on the roads drinking.
Mm-hmm.
So keep them just tipsy at .08, and then you can take them in. Do you know what Mel was the night he was... 1.01. That would be 0.03 over the legal limit.
Yeah.
0.03 over the legal limit is also not drunk. So I'm thinking show your true colors, not so drunk.
Well, you know, I don't know that. Is anybody really believing? And see, I've never had a drink in my life.
So I understand that, which is no one can understand or believe.
But I still don't think that I've seen people, except people that, you know, say, I love you, man, which is the thing I hate most about drinking. I don't mind people hitting other people.
Right.
I don't mind them getting anti-Semitic, certainly. I don't mind them swearing and throwing things.
Right.
And I don't mind the vomiting.
Right.
What I dislike intensely, you know, because I'm from New England, is someone who'll touch me and say they love me when they don't really like me.
So you would prefer hatred?
I would always. From a drunk person, I prefer hatred.
Right.
Yeah. I prefer. I know how to handle hatred from a drunk person.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You can just kind of get away from them. It's
right.
The affection of a drunk person
mm-hmm.
that creeps me out.
Yeah.
But I never believed. I mean, Mel Gibson, I think, was telling the absolute sober truth.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. Okay.
I think we'll get past that.
So The Lost Room is this miniseries, and I'm very excited about it because it was just so weird to read, and then to be a part of it was really fun.
How the hell did you get to be a good actor?
I don't know.
Because I saw you playing the president in something.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a small movie.
Yeah,
and
Deterrence, yeah.
You're, like, really good at it.
Thank you.
You're really good at, like, everything, and you have no reason to be. You're an impressionist.
Not only that, never attended an acting class in my life. Not proud of it. Just happens to be a
bad. Did you want to be an actor?
Came out of movies as a 5 or 6 year old, obsessed with one particular character, or so I was told by my parents. And I would be that character for a couple of days. Not doing an impression, just obsessed by whoever that person was and pretending I was them. And that's sort of how I grew up, going to the movies. Someone in that film just grabbed me. And I realized later that maybe I was being inspired by these people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the impressions came naturally, this freak gift. I don't think there's any special anything to it other than that. Never studied audio or videotape. It's just, you know, I hear voices in my head, and these happen to be famous. So, yeah, the acting thing was like, you know, when I do the impressions, I feel like I'm portraying another character. I mean, I think I could really do this.
But what made you? I mean, every other comic, good comic,
right,
that you see acting, just essentially is the character. You know, they just put the character with different lines. It's the same person they do. But especially in Deterrent,
right?
You know, you really didn't seem to have
any riffs.
You know, Bob Dylan says that what he wants to do is play guitar without any tricks.
Mm,
you know,
mm.
And your performances often seem like they don't have any tricks. They just seem like really good acting.
Because I found that all I could really do was be believable. That was it. That's what I brought to it.
But isn't that 100% of the job?
Yeah, as it turns out. Speaking of luck, speaking of stepping in it, turns out that's all they want. And when I was working on A Few Good Men, J.T. Walsh, brilliant character actor,
mm-hmm.
his whole career, was talking to me about it, saying, you know, what you're doing is actually a technique called less is more. And it's just about being believable.
You were designing buildings at that time?
Yeah, exactly. And he said, but there's actually a second part, which is less is more, nothing is best. So if you can literally do nothing in a scene and be the one stealing the scene, well, then you win, don't you?
Yeah.
And it was pretty extraordinary. And, you know, and Rob Reiner on that movie said, you know, I got Jack is going to end up swinging for the fences. Tom is certainly going to have to swing for the fences. I need you to hit, like, a solid double in the gap and drive home a couple of runs. That's
and
all,
you,
that's
you understood
all I
that
need.
Sports
I'm sorry. I momentarily spaced on who I was talking
to. You thought you were talking to a regular guy for a moment,
no, no.
Right?
No, no, no. Okay, hadn't made that jump.
Okay, good, good.
Just thought you had heard. Yeah, as it turns out, all I can really do in front of the camera is kind of what they want, and aren't I lucky for that? Because from stand-up, you know, we develop a stage presence.
Well, sure, that's it.
And that's it. And it's about being comfortable. Mm-hmm. And so, turns out I can be that comfortable in front of the camera to just be. And
what was the first movie you did?
Well, the first, I don't mention.
Okay.
Although I think it's important your worst film be your first.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, in terms of...
Who's that lucky? You're the guy that's that lucky?
Until Juana Man, and then... We got a very close runoff between the first one. Dino De Laurentiis attempted to remake, or dare I say, rip off, It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, and gathered several comedians, Rich Hall, Rick Overton, Mac and Jamie, Pam Madison, all these people, mm-hmm. and did this movie called Million Dollar Mystery.
Oh, yeah, yes. I saw that.
No, you didn't. Where they had... Where they had $1 million in a Glad bag. And the Glad bag company jumped on board to promote this thing. And decided they were going to give away $1 million. Dino De Laurentiis was going to give away $1 million to whoever went to the film, figured out the clues within the film, mm-hmm. where $1 million was hidden somewhere in the country in a Glad bag. turns out more than one person could guess it,
mm-hmm.
and although only 9 people saw the film, more than one person could guess it, so they ended up putting the correct people's guesses into a hat and pulling out the name. Oh. So now you've won the lottery. You actually haven't guessed anything. Mm-hmm. And a 14-year-old in Bakersfield won $1 million. Dino De Laurentiis somehow went bankrupt. And she became a collector along with everyone else.
Oh, you're kidding me.
No, I'm not.
A 14-year-old girl in Bakersfield.
Never got the cash.
And that girl's name?
I have no
Franklin.
Idea.
Franklin. No. there is one bitter tween.
Oh, man. Pretty brutal. So that was the first and... Yeah, and Willow was the second one, and then Avalon, the Barry Levinson film.
Willow was like the fantasy thing, right?
Yeah, it was a 7-inch tall character, Brownie, yelling, this way, no, this way! Rick Overton and I, Brownies in that.
Rick Overton was in Willow?
Yeah. He and I were the two Brownies. Rule and Frungy.
But you weren't, you're not a dwarf.
No, sir.
Okay, just want to make that clear.
Well, those 7 inches, every man's dream.
Impressionist.
That's right. Impressionist week, not dwarf week. So,
and you're also in Steal This Movie. My wife just handed me a note.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Very excited you were in that.
Yeah. Vincent D'Onofrio with Abby Hoffman.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that, but hear the music coming up?
We're out of time.
That means we're done. I'm going to talk to you off the air so I can hear the real truth.
Okay.
I'm with Kevin Pollak, who shows on the sci-fi, Lost Room.
The Lost Room, the miniseries, the 11th, 12th, and 13th of December. Great to see you, Ben.
Wonderful to see you. Kevin Pollak, one of the aristocrats here. Bye-bye. We out?